Welcome to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete Sunshine 96.7 FM. Join us as we celebrate the sparks that ignite, the events that inspire, and the songwriters that create. With your host, Steve Robb.
New England-raised Jenny Reynolds began her career performing at open mics in the Boston area in the early 1990s while working as a high school English teacher. After several years of performing, she quit teaching to pursue music full-time, and she continues to do creative writing workshops with school-aged children. In 2003, she moved to Austin, Texas, and was a Caraval New Folk finalist that same year. So following her mission statement of work hard, be nice, and keep moving, she's currently at work on her sixth album. So Jenny Reynolds, welcome to Song Creating.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you along. So keep moving. What's your driving force these days?
It's funny. We only have, the same number of notes. You can't say eights when you're talking about notes. But there's always a new song to write. There's always a new song to learn. My current record, Any Kind of Angel, is an example of what can happen if you keep learning more and more guitar. There's a much more aggressive guitar playing on my part on that record. And your question is very timely because I just am scheduled lessons with a fellow teacher at the National Guitar Workshop. I used to be a teacher with the National Guitar Workshop, and Glenn Rexach was a teacher with the workshop as well. And I'm working hard on hybrid picking on semi-hollow guitar. And I'm going to shorten that learning process by taking lessons.
Wow.
So that's one way to stay in motion, is just to keep learning. I want to keep learning this.
Good for you. So the hybrid picking, describe that a little bit more.
Hybrid picking is when you hold a flat pick between your thumb and first finger, and then you still pick with your middle and ring finger.
I've been seeing that a lot on some country pickers really seem to like that, and I think it's brilliant.
Particularly, and if you ever listen to somebody doing chicken picking, you can't do it without hybrid picking. It's also really fun to see, if you find a hybrid picker, what they do with the flat pick when they're not using it. If they ever have a pattern that doesn't use it, they usually tuck it in the ring finger and pinky, which is really fun to see. Like, I don't know, I'm always staring at a player's right hand because we're all playing the same chords. So it's really about the right hand.
Do you find, is this kind of a Texas Austin thing that you learned? I mean, you've been down there now for 20 years, but do you notice that style of picking is different from New England folk players versus Texas folk players?
I don't think so. There's still a pretty good amount of attention to Travis picking the alternating bass in 4/4. Mm-hmm. But I think, and P.S., the Travis picking is like a really good example of Travis picking is the boxer, Paul Simon, Simon and Garfunkel, with the alternating bass. But I think, I don't think that so much. But I could be wrong. I think what I notice more a difference between Texas, Austin, and the Northeast is the focus on is different. Like, what people appreciate is on the stage. It's like in the Northeast, there seems to be more of a focus on the songwriter. Mm-hmm. And in Austin, it feels like there's more about the song. Mm-hmm. So it's more about, like, for the sake of the song and the Townes Van Zandt ethic. And I love that because it just feels a lot less egocentric.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like there's kind of a fine line there, but I guess I can understand that. So you've been down there now for 20 years, but you left your teaching job in New England before you moved down. So you've really been doing this, how many years now that you've really been...
1995. I just did a gig with Jess Klein last night, and Jess is a fabulous songwriter that I don't think I saw her on your
site. Not yet.
She's a wonderful songwriter, and she's working a lot with Jonathan Bird now. She's from New York, and we cut our teeth doing the singer-songwriter thing, middle 90s.
Yeah.
So we did a gig last night with Susan Gibson, who is another fabulous songwriter. She wrote Wide Open Spaces, the Chicks hit. But
I think Susan Gibson, didn't Jana work with Susan Gibson?
She sure did. Yeah. In fact, Susan in the middle of the show actually said that she met Jess and I through Jana. So, you know, it's, I think we're starting a little bit of a 6 degrees of Jana Pocop thing. I love Astronaut, and I absolutely love her ethic in terms of creativity and songwriting. Jana is good people.
Yeah,
she's. I just texted her. I want to be her when I grow up. So, yeah, I moved here in 2003. I thought I would be here a couple of years. I had gotten laid off from a record label. Basically, my story started with a record called Colored in Poetry, which I recorded very slowly from about 95 through 97. It was financed with tips from open mic tip jars. It's done enormously well for me. It was produced by Thomas Eaton up in Newburyport. The thing that happened, you know, I was teaching when that record was being recorded. I wasn't tenured or contracted. I had a master's in education from Boston College, but I was teaching mostly fill-ins for maternity leaves. And
so all different subjects?
Just English. The thing that happened was I was in touch with a publicist, and she put me in touch with a music licensing agent who at the time owned a company called Heavy Hitters Music. And Heavy Hitters got every song on my first record onto soap operas, which is, for 3 years, they were full uses. And that meant I could stop working full time. Wow. So what I did then was just, I went to substitute teaching, and then it's really hard to get up early when you have a music life, even if you're not like a rock musician or a punk musician, you're still getting home kind of late.
Yeah.
So I went back to sort of the 9-to-5-er thing. And when I, just before moving to Texas, I had been working for a record label called Tone Cool that was two blocks from my rent controlled apartment in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Rent control.
I didn't know that existed.
It didn't for very long. I was only there. I was there for 9 years, but for like the first 2 years, it was rent controlled, and then very much not rent controlled.
Anybody listening who doesn't know Wellesley, Massachusetts, it's a very Tony town.
It totally is. I lived above a restaurant, across from a UU church, and two blocks from Tone Cool Records. And at the time, we had Susan Tedeschi and the North Mississippi All-Stars. And by the way, both of those artists, particularly Luther Dickinson in the All-Stars, they influenced my songwriting, my playing, my performance style. Working for Tone Cool was another way to go to school.
Wow. Did you, when you were, we hitting the open mic circuit in Boston, that I assume that's the Boston-Cambridge area, all of that. You must have run into like Vance Gilbert and Ellis Paul and all these
guys. Yes, definitely. Vance taught me how to be a performer on stage. I did his workshop in the middle 90s and learned how to adjust a mic stand and how to tune and talk at the same time. Vance is, he's a drill sergeant. He's the nicest drill sergeant you'll ever have. He's a wonderful guy.
He was at the first New England Songwriters Retreat I went to that Ellis Paul created. And the first class I had with Vance, it was a very short one, just Friday night after we had dinner and everything, and asked for a volunteer. And of course, you know, I'm never shy. I get up and I start playing a song. Well, first thing you taught us was how to plug your guitar in without looking down at it. You know, that was the first thing. You know where that socket is. Just plug the thing in. But then I'm playing, and he says, stop, stop, stop. And he walks up to me, and he reaches up, and he pulls my glasses off. He says, there. And I've been self-conscious of wearing glasses on stage ever since. But I also got better looking frames. I think I may have had not the right frames. And he's got these bright, he said, if you're going to wear glasses, make it count. So Vance has got these bright red glasses and probably other colors too.
Well, they need to be more of a fashion accessory than a vision enhancement. Or
actually, and he pointed to his glasses, and his capo is the same color.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. That sounds very advanced too. I'm blind as a bat. I am blind as a bat. I think I've always been blind, but didn't realize it until I had an uncle who was an eye doctor, and I didn't realize what I was supposed to be able to see. I hear you on that. I think if it's the wrong pair of glasses or if something else, like a hat, the wrong hat, even, you know, the wrong outfit, the wrong anything, is going to be a distraction.
Yeah, that's true. I want to hear a little bit more comparisons between New England and Austin. When you moved down to Austin, had you visited there? Were you familiar with it all?
Yeah, I went to Folk Alliance when it was held in Vancouver. Folk Alliance is an international conference that's held annually. Usually it's in Kansas City. The last time I went was in 2020, right before the pandemic. It was that year it was in New Orleans, which was fantastic. But in the early 2000s, it was in Vancouver. And I actually went reluctantly, but it changed my life. I met a ton of people from Texas, from Kerrville, from Austin, Houston, and Dallas. And I was touring there in Austin and Texas before I moved here. And I really did think I would be here a couple of years. Moving was kind of a byproduct of getting laid off. It happened about 8 weeks after being laid off. But
did you have a goal when you moved there, like that you thought would take 3 years and then come back, or what was your thinking? Why
kind of spread out a little bit, you know? But you know, I come from a family. None of us lived outside of the area code at the time, and it was just I'm a very much a New England girl. I still root for the Red Sox. I know where to park in Boston, but I don't tell anybody. I think what it really did it for me in terms of staying here, I made some really great friendships and some really great business alliances, and it's wonderful when those things are one and the same.
Yeah.
I have that in Boston. I have that in Austin. Big shout out to Matt Smith at Club Passim and to Neil Eckstein in Sudbury with Fox Run House Concerts.
Yep.
People that I happily call friends, Eric Schwartz. They're just great friends, people I'd want to know anyway, even if I wasn't a performer. I really just thought I was spreading out. But what's kind of kept me here is again, that ethic about the song being more, you know, the song has a different place on the stage than the songwriter. And I love that. I don't know. I think the economy also kind of kept me here a little bit. We didn't have a recession that occurred up in New England, just didn't really happen here. The other thing that kind of kept me here is there's just tons of venues. And also there are tons of players down here that are based here that I don't want to live far away from.
What you say about all the venues there in Austin is, mm-hmm. I mean, Boston is so limited. They actually just now, hired a woman to, whose sole role within the government is to try to get Boston to lose its reputation as being a boring city. You know, the bars close at 1, the mass transit stops at midnight. There's no happy hour. You know, it's just, you just can't have any fun here. I mean, you know, the difference between the two is just night and day.
When I was living in Wellesley in the aforementioned rent control apartment, it was a dry town.
Yes.
And
right.
It was so dry that, like, on the border of other towns, like with Natick and other towns, right on the border, there's a liquor store, you know, as we say in New England, a package store.
Yeah.
But Wellesley College at the time had a bar in their student center, in the Schneider Center, and it was called Molly's Pub. And I still have a T-shirt from Molly's Pub. They invited me to play there. And I played there a few times. It was great. I love playing there. It just made me, right away, it made me feel like if I had known this existed, I would have done better on my SATs, you know? Really great people doing purposeful things. And doing it in a bar centrally located on the college campus, it was great fun. So on the back of their T-shirt, which they gave me for performing there, the front, of course, says Molly's Pub. The back said, "Where every night is ladies' night."
So did you grow up in the Boston area?
Yeah, I grew up in Westwood. right next to Dedham. We moved there when I was three. At some point, there wasn't much there when we moved there, but it became way more populated in the 40 years that my family owned a house there.
Did you get into the whole, the high school music program or?
You know, I did, not as much in Westwood, but I did go to Westwood High for a little bit. And I went to, another school that had a jazz band. And at this time I'd been playing guitar for quite a while. But there were upperclassmen that had been, you know, playing in the jazz band longer than me. So there were like 606 guitar players ahead of me for playing guitar in the jazz band. So I went home one summer and learned to play drums. I got a job at D'Angelo's sub shop, and I got another job scooping ice cream, and income from those jobs helped me buy a Tama Imperial Star drum set with some really fun hi-hats, Paiste hi-hats, and a couple of used Zildjian cymbals and whatnot that I think I got from Norfolk County Music over near Leechmere on Route 1 in Dedham. Neither store is there anymore. the jazz band actually got me thinking about chops, about, you know, it's not enough to write songs. It's not enough to play some guitar. It's better to know your instrument and, you know, grow your soul with your instrument.
Well, were you playing drums in the jazz band? Because that's a whole different thing.
Yeah, that used to really mess with my head. And I think I would call myself a capable drummer. I am not a great drummer. I know enough about drumming to really love drummers, particularly Manu Cachet, Stuart Copeland, Masumi Jones, who's a jazz drummer in Austin, who is Greenwich Village good. She's got this rich buddy. She's got a Buddy Rich thing going on with her. It's absolutely stunning. Yeah. Hardest thing I ever played was a Dave Brubeck song in, we had a meter of 9/8. It's called Blue Rondo a la Turca. And it's counted 1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2-3. And then the B section switched to 4/4. So for a drummer and a young drummer, thought she wasn't young. It was a big challenge. Yeah.
It's a lot of thinking.
Yeah. But it made me a better guitar player.
I'll bet.
Maybe a better guitar player.
Well, jazz in general is just, I think everybody should learn as a guitar player, learn some jazz chords, learn some of the styles, because there's so many chords that are played in jazz that you just don't get in folk and Americana, or rarely get.
And I think that's true. The first major 7 chord I ever heard was this James Taylor, and it's in Fire and Rain.
Yeah.
Major 7 chord is a nice jazz chord. And I would say, you know, listening to Suzanne Vega, her song Caramel has these beautiful jazz chords, artists like Suzanne Vega and Nora Jones make me feel like.
And Joni Mitchell had terrific. Yeah,
absolutely. Artists like Nora Jones and Suzanne Vega make me think that the line between jazz and folk is still blurred. And the first person to blur them was probably Joni. With the Mingus record.
Well, there's always overlap, but a lot of folk that you hear in Americana is really pretty straight majors, minors, and sevenths. And you don't hear ninth chords and, you know, flatted sevenths and things like that that often. They just don't quite fit in. Do you know enough about drumming now that you feel confident when you're recording to be able to say to the drummer who you're working with, no, that's not what I want, this is what I want, and be able to actually communicate that to him?
Sometimes. More often, I can just participate in a conversation with the drummer and we come to decisions together.
Yeah.
But I'm at least 50% in the process, but I love the other 50% that comes from the other person. I like to play with other people. I like to play on my own too. I definitely cut my teeth that way. In college, I played at the auditorium, Heinz Convention Center auditorium stop, when Mary Lou Lord wasn't playing there.
You're talking about the transit stop.
Right in the subway station. I had my little Mighty Mouse amplifier and with the big battery that came out of a big, huge flashlight. The ethic is just, I want to play with others because of what they give to it. And so the conversation about what a drummer could do is definitely one that I participate in, but don't overrule or overlord.
Right.
Right.
But it's always good to get that's part of the whole production. You've got to get other opinions in this thing.
Yeah.
It's other ingredients in the soup. No question. So when you were doing the workshops with kids, were these songwriting or just creative writing in general?
I've done both. When I was an English teacher, English was in the school curriculum. It was part of the humanities program. Basically, what I would try to do is help kids develop ideas by calling attention to something like point of view. So we might start by looking at Picasso. And of course, I was focused on high school kids. But when we're looking at something like Picasso, who tries the cubist approach, where there's multiple angles of perspective, and then you read something like Faulkner, As I Lay Dying, every chapter is narrated by a different character. Multiple perspectives. The song that we're going to talk about today, each verse, multiple perspectives. When you get a single picture, it can be accurate if the observer has a good view. But I think it's always interesting to just look at something from another angle. This is what gave us Wicked, which is, of course, the different point of view of the Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. So we need things like that to help us get a whole picture. Yeah. So as a instructor of creative writing, that was very much my, that's the way I approach things. In terms of workshops with kids for songwriting, which I have done, I used to do them when I would supplement guitar lessons with my students by giving these workshops in the summertime when, they're not in school and they didn't want to do the same old thing. We might do a week-long workshop on songwriting. And for that focus, we would use some example songs and just talk about what a good story is and how a good story can become a song. And what are the essential parts of a song? Verse, chorus, bridge, good examples of those things. And I think the best thing that came out of that was attention to detail and an equal attention to honesty. So years ago, Mary Gaucher had a workshop at Club Passim called Tell the Truth and Make It Rhyme. And in that workshop, she taught two things that I've held very dear ever since. One is write a song about something that scares you. And another one was, if you can't tell your own truth, tell someone else's truth. Hmm. Well, that sounds like autobiographical fiction. And it really treads on, it really makes you think about how you're defining truth.
Well, and how do you define someone else's truth? I mean, exactly. that's pretty vague.
It is.
Or open-ended.
But the vagary, or the fact that it's vague, gives you a lot of room to create a story that sounds like everybody's story.
Oh, this could be someone else who you're making up, in other words.
Could be, yeah.
Not someone else in the room, yeah.
Yeah. I think also the trick to songwriting, that it's really hard to impart this on, when I was a teenager, there were never enough notes. They never could be played loud enough or fast enough. But really, Miles Davis and the whole Music is in the Spaces thing, a lot of times it's the truth for lyrics too. It's not about what you say and what you sing, but what you leave out. Mm-hmm. It lets a listener put in their own sentiments.
Sitting all alone, couple sees their firstborn off, tears in pairs of eyes. This is the way we say goodbye. They used to be an item, they used to share a bed. Went to fancy parties, turning everybody's heads. Now they sit across a table, texting their replies. This is the way we say goodbye. All that we have, all that we are, skin and heart and bone. The way that we love, no matter how hard, it's making heaven whole.
You know, I think working with kids or just being with kids in any way, one thing that I got out of it was just humility. Not just, you know, humility itself, but the reason why humility is important. I for me, working with kids is, it just makes me all the more grateful to do this because they don't have filters. And so you learn a lot about they're sometimes when they have an intense feeling, it's the first time they've felt it, and they'll write a song about it and then they'll share it with you. And this is, they are a walking open wound. Mm-hmm. And they'll just share it with you. And it's this beautiful experience that, you know, we as people can have when someone expresses himself and we get to witness this in the form of a song or writing. I'm not a very religious person, but the closest I get to it is being a creative person. And kids have, like I said, without a filter, it was very difficult to not, the first emotion I would feel when they would have confessional pieces that they would share with me, the first emotion I would feel is just being grateful to be there with this kiddo.
Yeah. Were all of the kids, it sounds like this was an elective that they chose to participate in, but as an English teacher, were there, you had to have come across kids who just didn't know how to even reach deep in and find that, whether you know, expressing it properly in words is a whole other, is that's another a higher level of ability. But just being able to access that emotion is a big part of it. And was that part of the whole process that you took them through?
If they would let me, yeah. I mean, a lot of times people and kids, you know, even adults, they don't want to go there. If you don't want to go there, it's going to be hard to do this. It's not going to be impossible. You could probably write jingles or, you know, pitch corrected songs that wind their way up on charts and, you know, have big payouts. But if you want to do what John Gorka is doing, if you want to do what Ellis Paul does, if you want to do, honestly, what John Mayer or Norah Jones does, James Taylor, mm-hmm. I don't think you can get away with that. You need to be in touch with the, you know, yourself and the motherload. I think it, the motherload of emotions. I think it, it shows if you're not,
You've got to expose your vulnerable side.
Yes.
You're listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM. Your song, The Way We Say Goodbye, starts out with, as we said, beautiful finger picking. And talk about different perspectives, as you said. So tell us how what sparked this song.
Well, I'm glad we're talking about this song. I live right in Austin, and if you live in Austin, you can play gigs at the Austin Airport. The airport has 10 stages, and they're Monday through Friday. All the stages are active. There's a 2-hour gig there, and it's a fully paid gig that has a corporate sponsor. It's the only gig that I have that I get scanned for. It's really a great gig. One of the things you can do there is actually, if you have a band, you can have a paid rehearsal. You know, your people are paying attention to you, but it's not like you're playing Sanders Theater. But it's a full sound system gig. It's a paying gig. People are listening. You will sell, you know, you'll sell some merch. But what you can really do there is people watch. And if you're a songwriter, people watching is a really essential thing. This song started from seeing people say goodbye. And I think the first two verses came from seeing two different kinds of goodbye. The first one is parents letting their kid go, get off on a plane. I remember that was actually on the curb. And I saw that and I walked by it and it was clear what was going on, but I walked by it and it kind of went into my head. It got under my skin and it stayed there.
Was this like a college age kid or a adolescent?
It was somewhere between, but probably 18 or 19, you know, but I think you're hitting it right that time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle of the gig, there was a couple sitting at the same table physically, but not emotionally. And you could just tell. I remember I was sitting there playing songs and I'm still kind of staring at them. And at one point I decided they were not siblings, but they weren't quite a couple either. And then as they spent their time there and I kept playing my set, it became clear that they were a couple, but it was more of like an obligation. It wasn't, it just wasn't romantic anymore.
I would imagine my wife and I, after too many hours in an airport waiting for a delayed flight, might have looked the same way.
it's a little unfair to think that.
But this is what's so much fun is that you know it's almost like some kids game where you see people and you start, oh no, actually, you know what I'm thinking about? I'm thinking of America by Paul Simon. And the guy with the gabardine suit is a spy. So you're making up all kinds of fun things here, or maybe not fun. But regardless, though, I think the whole direction that you're going here, it's an airport. People say goodbye. It's something. There's a lot.
I think If you go to a shopping mall, you could see the same thing. If you ride public transportation in any way, it is a perfect, anywhere there's a melting pot of different kinds of people. Another one that you might think of is election day when you go to a poll. Everybody's there, all different walks of life. We're all there. And there's usually something else going on that distracts us and keeps us from being inauthentic. Like the real task at hand in an airport or on public transportation is getting somewhere. And I think that prevents people from putting on airs.
Yeah.
But it is, there's a real opportunity to get to know people that I appreciate a great deal.
I think I hear your pooch in the background.
Oh, that's my neighbors probably.
Oh, okay. So there's, you mentioned, well, in the song, you talk about both of the examples that you just cited. Did you feel in the process of creating the song, did you want to start making up some other ideas? And I'm actually wondering, I mean, the big goodbye is the passing of somebody. Did you think about adding that in here, or did it not contextually work right?
You know, if you're talking about the types of goodbye that people go through in their lives, there's probably a romantic goodbye, but the big one is death, you know,
right.
So it was always going to be there. If you're going to talk about goodbyes, there's going to be some part of the discussion is going to include that. So yeah, I guess so. And I guess the biggest decision was where it should go in the song. There's this expression in music, in songwriting, where when you want to make a song gain weight or become increasingly interesting, you let that happen by determining, there's a few things that can help you do that. You know, for example, you might play a D chord in the same place in every verse, but in the last verse, you might play that as a D7. You can add weight with music choices. But with the level of intensity of a verse, you can do that too. And so obviously the goodbye that is about death, which is a permanent goodbye, is the last verse. Yeah.
So I was wondering about that, whether or not that was the last verse. I actually thought it might have been about your own romantic experience and saying goodbye to someone. So it's, which is great in a way that people can interpret, you know, lyrics in a way that connects with them the best. But the cloud, of course, I wasn't sure if that might be heaven or if that might be in an airplane, you know, literally flying, you know, across the sky. So then you did address that in this song.
Yeah. At the time, you know, my wife had a terminal illness, a rare neuro disease that took a long time to diagnose. And by the time she was diagnosed, maybe 6 weeks later, she died. So, so for me, there was a bias to this type of goodbye. But I also didn't want to bludgeon an audience with it.
Yeah.
And also, you know, it's hard to stop that conversation. You know, there's awkward segues from that. And that's true in songwriting too. The minute you open that topic, you can't really just go on to a poppy chorus.
Yeah.
But no, that was very much, about her passing, was about as graceful as it could be. And the cloud reference, I wanted some way to work in a reference to Joni Mitchell because, my wife loved her. So I thought that was a graceful way of expressing what was a graceful passing. It didn't make it any less hard. And if you want to know more of the hard stuff, I wrote a song called Before I Know You're Gone, which is a lot more black and white. You know, it's not a pleasant song, but it is an honest song. And I think the last verse of The Way We Say Goodbye, you know, The way we treat people that are helpless says a lot about who we are. The way we say goodbye says a lot about who we are too. And the way that I hoped to do it with her was to try to not be selfish, was to understand that when you have something good, like a wife or a friend or a sibling, we are blessed and lucky to have those people in our lives. And, you know, we might get overwhelmed by grief, but what you have to at some point recognize, if it hurt to lose someone, you must have had somebody great. And we have to be grateful for that.
Right. Right. Had you started this song, I'm not sure what the timeline was here. Had your wife passed before you had started this song or in the course of it?
This song actually came about very, very quickly. Most of the time I write, you know, way more verses than I need. And I go and later on, I choose the ones that work. And
I was going to wonder if you'd written a lot of verses and tossed them out.
I started this song in the airport and I finished it when I got home from the airport the same day. There aren't many songs like this anymore, but it wrote itself and I was a witness who got to write it down. Yeah. She had passed, but it hadn't come to my mind, I don't think. But it was definitely still on my mind. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. I've only lost my father as far as people really close to me. I'm still processing this 3 years later, trying to figure out how to write something for that. And it's just so, I just don't think I'm ever going to. I don't know. I think I just believe it.
I'm with you on that. I think, I think one of the great reasons to be grateful for creativity is that there are some things that happen to us that I don't think we ever really get over, but we just get used to.
Yeah.
And those things, I don't know. And I think, you know, grief is a fluid process. You're going to have good days and you're going to have days where just you're a wreck. But I think it makes sense to be open to those emotions because it lets us be open to the same emotions that contribute to creativity. Mm-hmm.
That is what makes songwriters, is you've got to open your heart up.
I hope so. I mean, I think, I hope it's okay to say that, we met through my brother.
Go ahead. That's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And, our mom was a beautiful musical soul. The first human voice I ever heard sing was hers. And I thought she was a magician. I had no idea that I could do it. But I was the youngest. So everybody was at work and school and mom and I would hang out and she would be doing stuff. And I would be under the dining room table where the tablecloth fell over the sides of the table and made this perfect little cave. And she would play records. So I was listening to like the Kingston Trio and the Beatles and all these musicals. And we just had this special time. And I think that stuck with us as people. And I hope that, you know, singer-songwriters, when we play places like Passim, Sanders Theater, we're close. You know, it's not like an arena show.
Yeah.
So I hope that people feel like the human closeness, I suppose there's fancy people that, you know, pretend and stuff. But I think if you're really going to see somebody, there's nothing between you. Yeah. You know, it's a pretty intimate experience, you know?
And as a performer, if that tear appears, you've succeeded.
You got to go with it. Yeah. And usually, I think Jess Klein told me this a long time ago. If that happens when you're writing, you've done a good thing. Mm-hmm. That, you know, and that's happened to me a couple of times where I'd be writing something down and I feel something on my face and it actually is a tear, but I didn't realize.
It's your own tear. Yeah. As opposed to your audience. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't feel like I was crying. I just, something happened and it wasn't, you know, pollen. yeah. But when something is deeply happening, there is this human, physical response. It may just be, I think it's the same thing when people laugh when they're nervous. Mm-hmm. something intense happens, the body does have to release, you know?
Yeah. I wrote one song about 10 years ago. And honestly, it could be a lifetime movie. It's about how I wrote a song for a girl 30 years ago who never heard it. And I had the opportunity. Now I was a famous musician. So I'm playing and I invited her to come and hear the show. And I played the song for her that she never heard. And I think it could make a great storyline. And, for the first time, I finally get to play for her the emotions that I had for her that I never really was able to express at the time. And, I finished that song and I just looked at it and went, I was almost like shaking because it seems so real. It's the intensity by which you immerse yourself into that song and surround yourself with that emotion that you're trying to express. And sometimes I just sit and I go, what am I trying to say? And I almost like I just put my head down and say, what is the feeling that I'm feeling, but I can't get the words to.
Sometimes when I'm writing, and I'm sketching out, if I have a first verse and a first chorus and I have like the theme of a song, then you're left filling in lines of later verses and maybe a bridge. And in terms of moving a story along or moving a theme along, sometimes I will write in a margin, what does this verse have to do? You know, what? So for a song like The Way We Say Goodbye, the second verse has to give us another example of another type of goodbye. But what type of goodbye is this? This is kind of a romantic goodbye. Mm-hmm. The first one was more about family and parents. So, you know, I would just write in a margin of a story song or any kind of song with a theme. What is the function of this verse? And then if you can't do that, that's usually a signal that your story or your theme is flawed. Because you should be able to say what happens in this verse. Well, in this verse, he finally says he loves her. And in the third verse, she says, I love you too. And then we all have this happy chorus. But maybe, you know, in the singer-songwriter realm, it's probably more like, you know, boy meets girl in the first verse, boy gets girl in the second verse, but boy loses girl in the third verse and has the pleasure of singing the song for like all time because he can sing the song and he's got the last word, you know. But you have these places in songs that have a function in the story. And if you can actually write down what is that function, it becomes easier to write the lyrics in those parts of the song.
Yeah. Do you find your lyrics drive the song or does your music drive your lyrics?
Okay. People ask this a lot. I have a pretty crappy answer. Okay. Here's my answer. I play a lot of guitar. I think music drives it first. But the first thing I do when I have a sketch of a song or an idea of a song with maybe a riff and a melody pattern, I use Moleskine books, these books here with the black cover. I've got another one in my bookcase. I have a shoebox full of them. I have a smaller one in a bag that I carry with me all the time. When a line comes to me, I'm sure you do this too. When a line comes to me, I just write it down.
Yeah.
And so when I've got a song kind of percolating, I go read my Moleskine books.
So this is the way we say goodbye. The topic of the song came to you before the music did. So I don't know if you actually had your verses written or at least you had the idea of the song in your head. Did you go through a variety of different styles of music, chord patterns? How did you settle on what you ended up with?
The only thing that I remember is that I wanted the descending bass line from a G to a D over F sharp, and I wasn't sure what key the song would be in. So on guitar, that meant...
Why did you want that?
Because the human ear loves a descending bass line, and this is a very human sentiment. Mm-hmm. Love and goodbye are probably the most basic human sentiments. Love and loss, really. Mm-hmm. And I think the human ear gravitates toward a descending bass line. Mm. And so a progression that starts with a descending bass line, you probably can't even call it a progression because it regresses if it goes backward, if it goes down. But but the G to D over F sharp. So I'm in a G chord, I'm playing a G on the sixth string, the low note.
Yep.
And when I play the D over F sharp, I'm playing the F sharp. So it's a half step down. Mm-hmm. And then to E minor, I went down another step. So so I knew that first line, it would be good there. So I knew that had to be in the song. But the big change really occurred when I'm a huge fan of Robert Earl Keane, and he got me thinking about 1 to minor 3. And so the G to F sharp to E minor is a progression I knew that would be in there eventually. But what made it more wistful instead of just down was to start the song on a C chord and then go to an E minor. So there was a decision there. It's another descending bass line, but it's not so close in steps,
mm-hmm.
because it goes from C to E. And it didn't descend the same way that G to F sharp to E minor, G to D over F sharp to E minor descends. It's a little more subtle.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that complemented the song because the song has its subtleties.
I want to listen to that more as I listen to it again. What I liked was, I think at the point when you, I think in both those verses, your last line, this is the way we say, I think in the word say, you go from a major chord, whatever it might be, it might have been a D, to that same minor,
mm-hmm.
right? I think it's yep. the same chord to that minor.
Yeah,
and
right.
that, I'm guessing that didn't come, that came after some thinking, after fitting in what would be, I mean, if I were playing it and writing it, I would probably go to, the fourth or something or somewhere that, you know, we're commonly do. And then you go, no, there needs something more here. And you just added that. That to me is the one part of the song that I, just was, it just grabbed me, and it was right at the perfect time.
Oh, thank you.
I love that.
I love that too. It's in a lot of songs, but I don't think people get tired of that change.
I think it was unexpected is maybe what, I'll have to listen to it again, but I think it just made me hear,
it's in a lot of songs, but I swear to God, it gets me every time I hear it. You know, I'm a sucker for that. I'm a sucker for that.
What else are you a sucker for?
Really good vanilla ice cream. my dog, who is totally spoiled. Any good melody, especially one sung by a humble songwriter.
Do you like the Mechanica in Austin very often?
Oh, Matt the Electrician?
Oh, my God, Mike the Mechanic. Yeah. Who's Mike the Mechanic? That's the band that came from Genesis. Matt the Electrician.
Matt the Electrician is a great guy. Yeah, Matt Siever. I haven't done a ton of gigs with him. He's a terrific songwriter here in Austin.
Yeah.
But I do produce a show called Williams Night, which is a tribute to Hank and Lucinda Williams. And he played Williams Night in 2019. And so I'm really excited to just call him a colleague, a compadre.
Yeah.
In the Austin scene, and definitely a songwriter that I learned from by listening to, one of the pillars of our songwriting community. Really great guy. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to let people know that you have a website. It's jennyreynolds.com. Yeah. Is that right?
Yep.
Jenny Reynolds. Yep. R-E-Y. Yeah, J-E-N-N-Y, R-E-Y-N-O-L-D-S. Although if they're looking on the podcast, they'll see your name spelled out right there. JennyReynolds.com. And you got a lot of stuff in the works and a lot of great stuff behind you. And
we started recording the new record. I'm a slow writer most of the time. That's what makes the way we say goodbye something of an exception, is it really came about in a couple of hours. But mostly I'm a slow writer. But we are working on the new record right now. We've got 3 songs. The basics are done. Working with the same team that did Any Kind of Angel, Mark Hallman and Andre Moran at Cedar Creek Recording in Austin, which was Jimmy LaFave's studio. It's a look forward to that, you know, late this year or early 2024.
Awesome. Yeah. Hard to believe we're even thinking about 2024, yeah. But we are. Yeah. I think that's the first time I've actually heard that you're mentioned in a conversation, but yeah, it's not that far away. God.
No, it's frightening, isn't it?
It's really, time just keeps passing.
Yeah. I don't know, but the only reassurance I have is that it's always, I've been getting old all my life, so why should I worry about it now? But
I don't know. I feel like I'm getting younger. Age is just, I'm getting less mature. That's one thing I know about. It's common. Ask your brother about that. All right. Jenny, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. It was great seeing you. And, we will be in touch.
Thank you. If you come to Austin, please look me up. I got a guest room, strong coffee, and a dog.
That's all I need.
Yep. Yeah.
That's all I need.
Yeah, I highly recommend it, especially maybe not in July, but, you know, we're a little political blueberry in the middle of a T-bone, but...
I've been there. No.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm really very grateful for this. It's nice to chat with you.
You're welcome. All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
We'll be in touch. Okay, bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete. If you like what you hear, you can find Song Creating on your favorite podcast app or at songcreating.com. To check out my own music, go to steverobb.com. And until next time, keep a song in your head and music in your heart. Thanks for listening.